21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
My shoes are worn out, walking down this same highway. I don't see nothing new, but I feel a lot of change. And I get the strangest feeling as I'm heading for the light.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. This is Dr. Bob Hieronymus, a lowly PhD and DFA, hanging out in this part of the universe, and sometimes we really do know where we are. And our executive producer and research assistant, Laura Kortner. Our engineer is Kristen Hegerich. Well, about 50 years ago, when I realized I was not going to become a priest or a minister, I then passed through the usual atheist, agnostic, then deist stages, and I was most content. I think I probably was one of the happiest atheists on the planet. Anyway, at that time, I believed all things that were in the paranormal world were just a waste of time. In fact, to me, they were kind of an emotional illness. Well, that was until I had my first experience with a poltergeist in my studio in 1964. What an arrogant fool I was. Yes, indeed. I really knew a lot, right? Well, needless to say, that was the start of my long journey into the fields of consciousness that opened me up to the fact that we are not alone in the universe, and there were many other conscious, semi-conscious, and unconscious beings on this planet that do go bump into the night. All during these seminal years, my favorite bookstore that re-educated me on all of these topics was the Wiser Bookstore in New York City. It was the nicest hangout we ever had. Well, hour one, our guest will be Varla Ventura. And two of her fascinating books, Among the Mermaids, Facts, Myths, and Enchantments from the Sirens of the Sea, and Banshees, Werewolves, Vampires, and Other Creatures of the Night, both published by Red Wheel Wiser Books. Redwheelwiser.com. I better spell that once. Red Wheel, Wheel, and I'll say it again. Red Wheel Wiser, WEISER.com. That's how you spell it. At least we got most of it there. Varla Ventura is the author of The Book of the Bizarre and Beyond Bizarre and Awe, and she's a lover of all things that are strange, freaky, and terrifying. She is the curator of the Wiser Magical Creatures and Paranormal Parlor series of ebooks, and you can visit her at the blog of the bizarre, varlaventura.wordpress.com. Welcome to 21st Century Radio, Varla.
Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it's an honor to, honor to have you. I just couldn't wait to get to this book on the mermaids, because mermaids are one of my favorite things on the whole planet. And we'll get to that in just a little while. But mermaid legends have a long history, as you know, and there are stories abound worldwide from Europe, Africa, China, Poland, America, etc. Would you provide just a couple of legends that you have reported in your book, Among the Mermaids?
Absolutely. Well, there's so many, and one thing that I think we associate mermaids in particular, they're very common in Irish and Scottish and Welsh folklore, but there actually are sort of mermaid stories from around the world, and one of the earliest mermaid stories is actually goes back to about 1000 B.C., and it's the story of an Assyrian goddess named Atargatis, who actually killed a mortal man by mistake. That she loved him and accidentally killed him, and then tried to hide herself in a lake, and she couldn't quite do that, so she turned herself into a half-fish in order to conceal herself. Out of that, that's one of the earliest accounts of sort of the half-woman, half-fish creature that also kind of includes that love, the love story which I think, you know, we do have a love affair with mermaids.
Yeah, we sure do. Well, look, I'm going to move on here to another one, other topic in this area. Now, one story I much enjoyed is The Mermaid of Druid Hill Park by Charles Weathers Bump. Now, you didn't know that Druid Hill Park is my favoriteest park in the whole planet. And I used to almost live there from time to time. I've even slept there and played baseball there and all kinds of stuff. So when I think of that pond there, well, it's not a very big one, but think of the mermaid being living in there. Could you tell us a little bit about the story of Charles Weathers Bump?
Oh, yeah. That is absolutely one of my favorite stories. And I've never talked to anybody that actually knew exactly where this Druid Lake was. It was written in 1906. It was part of a collection of stories by Charles Weathers Bump. And to be perfectly honest, the title and the name of the author just grabbed me because, I mean, Charles Weathers Bump, that's just like such a wonderful name. I don't know a lot about him. I know that he was a pretty prolific short story writer, and he was, you know, lived in Baltimore at the turn of the century. Just to let you know, there's a few other stories that he wrote, including one called The Pink Ghost of Franklin Square. So they're all sort of set in the Baltimore area. But I absolutely love this story because it is basically a mermaid joyride.
Yes, it is.
And it's funny. It's not quite what you expect. The nutshell version is a man is out for his daily stroll in the park and walks by the pond and sees this beautiful woman. And she tells him how hard it is because she's stuck in this lake. She's always in this pond. She never gets to go anywhere. And so she's so beautiful, he, of course, wants to please her. And now you have to remember, in 1906, what kind of vehicles they had. So basically, he gets this friend of his together, and they fashion sort of a traveling aquarium that they put on the back of this jalopy and take the mermaid out for a ride. And it's just funny. It's delightful. It's well-written, and it's just such a great, you know, so many of the mermaid stories have very similar plots, so it was really fun to find something that was a little bit off the beaten path.
Well, the interesting part of it to me was she watched these cars go by, and she really did want to ride in one. And she did convince him to do that, and he convinced his friend to lend him his car.
Yeah.
What happened to his car, though?
I think they like fashioned this thing and then they got in a car accident.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, of course, like that, I mean, not everyone had a car back then. So that was a whole other factor. And the thing I also really liked about this is the way that it played on that the mermaid can convince you to do anything, including just walk into the sea and drown because you'll do anything for her love and anything to please her. And so in this case, you know, that's trying to take her out for a ride in these strange automobiles and convince his friend that it's a good idea and sacrifice, you know, something that would, you know, really have cost quite a fortune back then.
Well, you know, I know most people don't think I'm a very skeptical person, but I really am. And so when I started reading this, it all sounded like it was from Baltimore. I didn't think it was from Baltimore, but after you described the monuments, especially my favorite monument on Wallace, you know, one of the great heroes, and they also have statues of Christopher Columbus and everything, who's not my great hero at all, but Druid Hill Park is a very mystical area place, and I think that's the reason why I just could not believe that this really was a story about Baltimore. Of course, later on, you note that.
I honestly, you are the first person that I've talked to that has been to that park that really got the visuals and the subtleties in the story. So that's good to know.
Well, you'd love its rolling hills, and it's now there are fences all over the place, and that's unfortunate. But And that's because some idiots, of course, would harm the animals at night because it's related to the zoo. Well, in the summer of 1997, underwater microphones were placed in the ocean by the United States Navy. What was the Navy seeking, and what was the result of that experiment?
Now, I believe that you are referring to the blip, what is known as the blip.
Right. Uh-huh.
Well, results have sort of remained undetermined. There's been a mysterious sound that, it was so distinct that the Navy actually, went to the great expense of putting these microphones underwater. And there's been a couple of inconclusive conclusions drawn, mm-hmm. essentially.
Yeah.
They can't determine that it has an animal-like quality, but they couldn't associate it with a specific animal. Now, since then, of course, people have come out, and the Navy has said that, it was nothing. We were picking up, something just sort of random, or, it was a fluke. But, I think it definitely gives you that impression that there were, I think there's no way that we know all of the creatures that lurk beneath the sea. We know we don't. We would discover new ones every day. And these sea serpents just washed up in the California coast. One was 14 feet long, one was 18 feet long. So it's this kind of thing that sounds like this great mythological account, but that actually has, its roots in truth. And, I think that the idea that there's a creature under there making a regular sound is...
I agree. I agree with you. The Navy's not going to admit any of this.
Oh no!
I mean, I'm laughing only because they're missing so much, and yet there's a whole other level of consciousness within the Navy that would accept this, but they're not speaking, and they're kind of in charge. They're not necessarily going to add to this kind of mystery. And I want to thank you for doing that little story there on the caddy or Cadborosaurus. And you're one of the very few of all the reference books that it was like a horse-headed like creature that's been up there in British Columbia for some time. And you, just like you noted, that we do have something of a photograph of it in much deteriorated condition.
Yes.
And it's undoubtedly one of the kind of things that you would expect that so many other people have seen, which is a kind of a horsey head. It's not really like a horse, but, so it's really not a monster from that standpoint. It's kind of cute.
Yeah, what's interesting about that is that I, not terribly long ago, traveled to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and did some sightseeing around the shores of Lake Superior. And there's, I believe it's on the Canadian side, there's a little park there, and the name of it actually escapes me. But there's several there's a place where you can kind of walk down, and there's rock art. And there's this really distinct sea serpent. And it actually, when I saw it, it made me immediately think of that, because it was like, wow, that sounds, it's got a horse head, it's a long tail, it's got a lot of legs that are kind of oar-like.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of legends that, there have probably been more shipwrecks there than any other coastline in North America. I mean, there's just hundreds of ships that have wrecked in that lake, and... There's the native legend is that this sea serpent is that's why you don't go too far out in the water, because there is a sea serpent in the middle and it will thrash around and drag you down.
Mm-hmm.
So I find it, I love those stories of the, sort of a little bit beyond the Loch Ness.
Well, we have a little creature in the Chesapeake Bay that's called Chessie. And once again, most people think it's been sighted a number of times, but But if you go to authorities, they're not going to accept anything like that. But I do believe, with some of the interviews that we did over 30 years ago with the people that saw it, that we indeed have some kind of a serpent-type creature within Chesapeake Bay. Now, is there any danger in an encounter with a mermaid or merman, as told in the legends or in real life? Are they trustworthy?
Absolutely not. They are not trustworthy.
Too bad.
Okay. I think we have a very, in justifiably so, we have a very romanticized version of a mermaid. And I think that, you know, in many ways that's inaccurate, you know, that it's mostly a beautiful woman with a beautiful voice that might lure you into the sea. However, the idea of the Little Mermaid as told by, you know, the Disney film, charming, nothing against it. I love the songs, it's great. But I do think it misrepresented mermaids. I do think they're darker creatures. I think they do have, I think they have an element of maybe a little bit of an animalistic quality where they hurt you without meaning to. Sort of like Frankenstein's monster or something. I didn't mean to hurt you. I didn't mean to crush you. I didn't mean to drown you. What do you mean you can't breathe underwater? I can, and you're so handsome. So I think that there's definitely that, you know, that luring quality. You hear about that with sirens and, you know, that kind of come with me under the sea. Everything will be fine.
Yeah.
So there's a darker element there, and that's part of the reason I wanted to write about that a little bit in the book, because, just be a little more realistic.
Yeah. Well, Ringo had a song on Octopus's Garden and Living Under the Sea, and, of course, the Yellow Submarine was tied into that. And I spent 30 years writing that book on the Yellow Submarine, which was something I thought was only going to take me a couple of years. But try dealing with the Beatles. It's not the easiest thing in the world. That's for damn sure. Now, I have one more question on this particular area. And my boss right now is telling me I have to break. But I'll give you a chance to bone up on this one before,
all right.
Okay? Because, you know, this is an important question. Now, one of my favorite UFO researchers, his name was Robert Temple. And his research is found in The Sirius Mystery. And it supports the idea that some aliens are amphibious and are that indeed have fish-like bodies in part. And I wanted to know if you were familiar with that research, and if so, what you might think about that. So you got about a couple of minutes to think about it, and you can cheat, too. You can Google it as we're taking a break. All right, friends, our guest is Varla Ventura. And the next book we're going to talk about is Banshees, Werewolves, Vampires, and Other Creatures of the Night, Facts, Fiction, and First-Hand Accounts. And right now we've been talking about the Among the Mermaids, Facts, Myths, and Enchantments from the Sirens of the Sea, both by one of my favorite publishers, Wiser Books.
Hi there, this is Lauren Coleman, co-author of Cryptozoology A to Z and The Field Guide to Bigfoot. You're listening to Dr. Bob Hieronymus on 21st Century Radio, one of the funniest guys that I know that looks into some of the best mysteries around. Enjoy.
Well, we really enjoyed ourselves this last couple of weeks reading these books. Our guest is Varla Ventura. And we are finishing up on Among the Mermaids, Facts, Myths, and Enchantments from the Sirens of the Sea. And we're about ready to launch into her other book. There are more than just these two. But we could only read two. I'm not the fastest reader on the planet, you know. By the way, if you want to visit Varla on the web, you can do that at Varla Ventura. I'm going to spell that V-A-R-L-A Ventura. .com. Ventura is Ventura.com. VarlaVentura.com. And you'll find that link on the front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com. Now, here's the big question. For $30,000 and a new boat and maybe four or five new cars, okay? You ready? Robert?
I want to win.
Okay, all right, okay. I can be bribed, you see, you know, just like they do on TV. Robert Temple, his research has found in a book called The Serious Mystery, and this book was done in the late 70s and has been updated. The Navy is pretty unhappy about it, supports the idea that some aliens are amphibians. I was wondering if you were familiar with that research, and if so, what do you think?
I'm a little familiar with it. I certainly think that there's a lot of connection between... I honestly don't know about the alien connection so much, but I do know that, you know, there's a lot of the ancient civilizations of Lemuria and Atlantis and similar places where at one time, you know, people were living above land and then they were lost at sea, or that they are underwater civilizations, and that many, many people believe that's what mermaids are and where mermaids come from, which I think makes a lot of sense. And I also think if you think about it a little bit scientifically, you know, you're not necessarily going to go underwater overnight, so there may be time to slowly adapt to, you know, life under the sea. Mm-hmm. But I'm not really, really familiar with Robert Temple. I mean, I've heard of that. I know there's like the idea of this planet Dogon, which there's actually a whole species of manatee-like creatures that are called Dogons, I believe. So there's, you know, there's some...
any way related to the Dogon tribe in Africa?
I don't know, actually.
Wow,
that's something I'm not really well versed in, the sort of the ancient alien connection to the mermaids. And I mean, I know it exists, and it makes a lot of sense. And even the Assyrian story that I told you earlier, you know, there's also like a star goddess kind of connection there.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't think it's a huge leap to make that assumption. This is not something that I don't get too into the UFO theories.
Well, I'll tell you what's going to happen here. You know your two books, and you know who they're going to go to? They're going to go to the Marley, Bob Marley and Ziggy Marley and Stephen Marley and that family, and also to the Hendrix family, because these are people that I've worked with, and they just love these particular areas and these particular topics.
Wow, that's great.
Let's thank your publisher, because your publisher was generous. And what we do is we don't sell anything. What we do is we make sure we try to put these books in the hands of other people that we know and enjoy them, but they don't have time to even find out that these books exist. They're working all the time. That's the way.
That's so awesome.
That's the music world all the time. You got to eat. Now, we're going to move now into the book Banshees, Werewolves, and Vampires and Other Creatures of the Night. And, actually, let me give you a general question here first. Now, you're known for collecting facts and long-forgotten stories. What made you decide on creatures such as this, the Banshees, Werewolves, and Vampires?
I sort of started undertaking a project for my publisher at their request, which was to basically scare up volumes of forgotten lore and find the backstory or maybe some sort of connective thread between those. And we did that as a series of digital books, like ebook only. And just sort of, you know, combing through these volumes, there were a few things that stood out to me. Mermaids are something that I've loved, you know, since I was a young girl, of course. And, you know, used to swim in the river where I grew up. There's a beautiful river, and, you know, used to spend all summer swimming in there with my sister pretending that we were mermaids. I think that a lot of people can relate to that. Mm-hmm. And then the other creatures, you know, that's just something that I've always been attracted to, mythology, to storytelling, and also to the idea, and something that you said in the beginning of the show about, you know, being a skeptic. And I consider myself a supernaturalist. So that's sort of like if, you know, somebody said, okay, like, what's your religion? Or, you know, I don't even know that I would call it a religion, but, you know, it's kind of it's like the opposite end of being an atheist, but at the same time also kind of the opposite of maybe being a Christian in some ways. It's the belief in the supernatural to the point that I become a little bit obsessed with it. And that's not to say that I'm alone in that belief. And it's not that I'm really a big ghost hunter. I mean, I've had paranormal experiences. I love learning about other people's and having them and reading about them and researching them. But I think this idea that there are, that tap on the window that you hear at night, the idea that it isn't just a branch, that it's just as easily going to be a little creature peering in at you. I've always loved that. Maybe I like a good scare, but that's something that I've always been very, very drawn to, the sort of the what if, the what is lurking out there.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, it was pretty shocking to me at the age of 20-something to find out that all my philosophy was going out the window in an afternoon. So I can understand why other people wouldn't even want to believe these kind of things, because then all of a sudden I realized when you run away from home, which I did, you're living in an apartment that has bigger rats than cats ever were. And, when you're very poor and you only have one meal a day for 5 years, then your view on things is a little bit slanted. That's how I'll say mm-hmm. It's one of survival. So, fear can be really quickly stimulated there. But we got to move into this book, Banshees. What is a banshee?
A banshee is traditionally, and there are many variations and counterparts to the banshee throughout the world, but a traditional banshee is actually from, is a fairy, part of the fairy realm in Ireland, often in Scotland. Now, again, there are the equivalent of banshees around the world. Sometimes they're not called banshees, but essentially it's a female. Always female. I've never heard of a male banshee. I'm sure someone could enlighten me to that, but I've never encountered any story of a banshee being anything other than female, unlike vampires or werewolves or mermaids. It's always a female-like creature, usually beautiful upon first glance, often hag-like or horrid upon close encounter. Also sometimes seen as just like a little old washerwoman or someone very harmless that you might overlook or not be afraid of until you, sort of get closer. Most distinct by the howling, screaming, mournful sound, something like Irish keening, something that you would do at a funeral. That's the, and not all banshees are, not every, just like with ghosts, some people see banshees, some people hear banshees. Generally speaking, if you hear a banshee, someone that you know is going to fall ill or possibly die within just a short period of time, if you see a banshee, that's definitely going to happen, and it very well might be you. So that's the more terrifying part of banshees, is what they represent. They don't actually do any harm. They can't really scratch you. They might, upturn your cupboard and smash a few dishes and toss things about in your closet, but they're not actually going to physically harm you. It's what they represent. They are symbols of, the death.
Well, could you give us your favorite banshee story?
Yeah, one of my favorite banshee stories actually is the story that a man named Elliot O'Donnell tells.
Oh, yes.
And Elliot O'Donnell was an Irish paranormal researcher from the late 1800s. He spent a lot of time collecting folklore, but there were many people that were doing this at that time. It was like the Grimm brothers were doing it in Europe. Yeats was doing it throughout Ireland as well. William Wirt Sykes was doing it in Wales. They were sort of going around collecting the stories of the peasants, so to speak. What was distinct about Elliot O'Donnell is that he did not have, while he was a scholar, he did not have the skeptic point of view. He didn't go into it thinking, oh, these are just stories. He had an experience when he was 5 years old. His own family was haunted by a banshee, So they sort of straddled somewhere between like the fairy realm and the ghost realm, really. And he told this great story about talking about how not all banshees are beautiful to the Irish Literary Society, and this woman getting up and being completely outraged that he would put forth such a theory. And the beautiful part about it was that she wasn't outraged that he was talking that banshees existed. She was outraged that he dare say that they weren't beautiful because her banshee that her family saw was beautiful. Mm-hmm. So it just really, I loved it because it just speaks to kind of like the layers in which the banshee is ingrained into, the way of thinking in Ireland and, of course, in other places around the world.
Well, we're actually almost upon our first break, our final break, that is, and which we're going to get involved in. And when we come back, it's time for us to start talking about vampires, okay?
Yeah.
You think you can handle that?
I agree.
Can you handle it, though? I mean,
yeah.
I know these are tough questions and everything, and you probably don't necessarily want to talk about these things, but we're going to force you to do it anyway, Varla.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Well, I'll suffer through.
Okay. All right. That's a way to go. We like people that like to suffer through stuff. All right. Now, of course, who are we talking to? Varla Ventura. And the book we're talking about now is Banshees, Werewolves, Vampires, and Other Creatures of the Night, Facts, Fictions, and First-Hand Accounts, and Among the Mermaids, which we talked about, and we're going to give one or two of those away when we come back. Hey, nothing about those multi-species cultures, right? All right, friends, we just stepped back in a previous incarnation here, and excuse me, would you like to win a free copy of the book that we're talking about, Banshees, Werewolves, Vampires, and Other Creatures of the Night by Varla Ventura, published by RedWheelWiser.com? Huh? Would you like to do that? Well, you got to answer a question. Who was our first hour guest who joined me the last time I hosted 21st Century Radio? That's right. I don't do this every week anymore. My wife does the other part. So, who was my first hour guest when the last time I was on? And you got to qualify. Here's how you do it.
If you know the answer to this hour's quiz question on 21st Century Radio and you have not won from us in the last 60 days, call in now. 410-922-6680. That's 410-WCBM-680. First with the right answer wins. Prizes are available for you to pick up at the WCBM studios in Pikesville after Friday of this week. Winners have 60 days to pick up the prizes and must wait 60 days before winning another prize from 21st Century Radio. Good luck.
This is Henry Bauer. I'm editor-in-chief of the Journal of Scientific Exploration, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and this is a show that is most worth listening to.
Remember Dr. Henry Bauer? Now, this is not the Hank Bauer that used to play for the New York Yankees and then the Baltimore Orioles. No, Henry is really quite something. And he'd be a good ball player, too. He batted left-handed, and I think he was, but he threw right-handed. He's a good man. Our guest, of course, is Varla Ventura. We're talking about her book, Banshees, Werewolves, and Vampires. And actually, we're just about ready to get into some vampires right now. And have you ever seen a vampire? Or have you ever met one?
Definitely have.
Well, tell us about it, please.
Well, I think we've probably all encountered, whether we realize it or not, the psychic vampire. And that's something that, you know, occultists have been writing about, ways to protect yourself from the psychic vampire for centuries. It's that person that just totally drains you. And it's not a metaphor. It's that you actually feel exhausted after they leave, and they feed on your energy. Technically speaking, a real vampire would be very self-aware and would know that they are doing this. And a responsible vampire would ask your permission. Some people like to give. Other people like to take. There's also a big subculture of, sort of glam vampires vampires that, you know, like to fashion fangs and on their teeth and dress in corsets and go to balls and sort of really embrace the glamorous, romantic side of vampirism. And the living vampire, who are descendants of some of the early Romani vampires who had relationships with the gypsies, and that actually, you know, had sort of reciprocal agreements for camping on the land and, you know, giving to the wealthy landowner, i.e. the vampire. And out of that, we have kind of some of the basis for Dracula sort of came from that idea in that time. And of course, I know several people that are involved in that community, and it's actually, you know, it's a mystical and magical community as well, with a lot of ritual and things like that.
Would you tell us your favorite vampire story?
Yes, my favorite vampire story. There's a lot of stories that I really liked the provenance of. There's one story that is related to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. So that's a great story. But the story that I really love is a story called Clarimonde.
Was
written
story.
In French. It was called Les Motes Amoureuses, I believe, is the French title. And this story, you know, this story is like, if you're easily offended, you might recoil a bit from the premise of this story. But it's basically, I'll just set the scene for you. It starts out, you've got a priest who's at the moment to take his final vows. And he's a young priest. And at that exact moment when he's about to utter his final vows, this woman walks into the church and just rattles him to his core. And he takes his vows anyway, and then sort of it goes on from there. There's a bit of a love affair. There's you're never quite sure if he's sick and he's dreaming, who's alive, who's dead. I mean, it's really kind of a mind thriller, and it's quite lusty, and I believe it was written in something like 1890, so it's also quite old, and I imagine for the time very controversial, considering that here's a priest doubting what he, you know, what he was committed to, and doubting, you know, the existence of God, and why he would even join the church when he, if he had just waited 1 minute longer, he could have been forever with Clarimonde. So it's a really a beautiful, beautiful story. I highly recommend it.
Well, so do I. Boy, it's certainly one of the longer stories in this book.
Yeah.
I was surprised at that. Because I thought I had figured it out about halfway through, and I was dead wrong. I didn't figure it out at all.
I know. I don't want to give the ending away because it's
either.
Not at all what you think, but it gets a little bit, it was quite dark, very dark.
Yeah, really
she
was.
She says cheerfully.
Well, you know, there's a lot of beauty in dark. Wow. Okay. Well, you know, there's one more we got to cover in here. Is werewolves. We didn't talk about werewolves. And the cover, I got to say, the way these books are laid out and all the gorgeous little drawings in them and all the colors, that person's, when you travel to Bermuda on your free trip there, you should take this person along with you. Because
I couldn't agree more.
Boy, I'm telling
yep.
you.
He's that, wonderful.
I got to especially say that cover on Among the Mermaids. I just fell in love with it. I mean, geez, a whiz. Well, but we got to talk a little bit about werewolves. Tell what is a werewolf?
Well, a werewolf is, you know, essentially a half man, half beast, half wolf. Usually, unlike, you know, maybe another supernatural creature that is always in that supernatural state, the werewolf is a bit of a shapeshifter and can be quite mortal and seem quite mortal and then sort of be plagued by the disease of being a werewolf. Sometimes you can tell a werewolf in a pack of wolves because there's one distinction, and that's that they don't have the tail that the wolves have. So that's one way to tell. And there's even theories that the sort of the loping gait that we associate with a werewolf has to do with the fact that they, in a pack of wolves, try and extend one of their back legs to make it appear like a tail so that they blend into the, you know, to the naked eye that might, I mean, I don't know how often anyone spots a random pack of wolves anymore, but, you know, it still happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's a disease. It's actually a legitimate, you know, a legitimate disease, legitimate. It's, you know, it's a, there's a clinical disease known as lycanthropy, and that is that the person believes that they are a werewolf. They exhibit the behavior of, and there's also variations in which, you know, there's a disease in which somebody actually, you know, grows excessive body hair, and that those are sort of like the bearded lady of, you know, the sideshow. That's, you know, another variation. But there's a very interesting theory, and there was a man named Sabine Baring Gould who kind of wrote about werewolves. He wrote a huge volume of work on werewolves, and he actually is best known for having written the hymnal Onward Christian Soldiers. You would never know that this
right.
man believed in werewolves, but he did, ferociously, haha. And he actually puts forth this idea that we all have the capacity to be werewolves, that we as humans have this inner ferociousness. We've all had a moment of, you know, seeing red, just feeling like, you know, utter violence throughout it. And there's examples of extremes, you know, someone like Jack the Ripper would be an extreme, you know, someone in, you know, just in an act of passion, you know, committing murder, things like that are the maximum capacity that we all have within us to a lesser degree to become a werewolf, to have that, like, no control over what you do, ferociousness, like a werewolf.
Well, Wisconsin has a lot of strange things going on, but it seems there. Would you tell us the story of werewolves in Wisconsin? I think this was about, what, 1936? Wait a second, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And then later
okay,
on,
so that's,
64?
Yeah, there's, I think it was, yeah, I believe 1936. And there's a particular stretch of highway in Wisconsin, Highway 18, and there was a man that saw something sort of loping along the highway. It was tall and beasty. It had glowing red eyes. And he actually, the second sighting that was, I think, 15 years later that was on record, was a very similar creature along the same stretch of highway. So Highway 18, which I think is like somewhere in the middle of Wisconsin. I've never traveled that road myself, but the next time I'm back that way, I have every intention of taking that route.
Well, when you compare the three of these, which was that is the banshee, the werewolf, or the vampire, which one do you think is the most terrifying, and which one do you think is the most misunderstood?
I definitely think the werewolf is the most misunderstood. I think that, you know, they sort of have this, they kind of have a bad rep, but it's really not their fault. And when you think of it from the point of view of, you know, you can kind of relate to it. I mean, it's not an undocumented phenomena that on the full moon everybody gets a little bit crazier. So imagine being, you know, fully affected by that and then trying to go back and live amongst the people that you love, knowing that you might tear them to shreds. It's very sad. but the, you know, I think the vampires, you know, been mostly well represented. I think we were, of course, have romanticized the vampire to an extreme like we have with mermaids. But overall, I mean, you know, I think the general idea of the vampire has been pretty consistent. The banshees are probably the most terrifying, and they're terrifying because they indicate that somebody that you love is going to die, and that's a terrifying thought.
Yes.
It really is.
Mm-hmm. Well, hey, by the way, now that Halloween is over, what did you do on Halloween? You know, one of the most disappointing times in my life was I was contacted by a television station, and they wanted to know what I was going to be dressed up as Halloween, and I told them it was going to be Dr. John Dee. I wanted to be Dr. John Dee.
Nice.
And
They didn't get it, did they?
No, they did not even understand. Who in the hell's he?
You know? They probably thought it was a rapper or something.
Yeah. So what did you dress up as this year?
Well, actually, I was a cat. I have a young son, and he really wanted to be a mom cat and a baby cat, and it was the first year that he was able to trick-or-treat. So it was a blast. I had a great time. You know, I do traditionally have a big party with a lot of my friends, and we do a theme and, you know, have this insane cake and all kinds of, all manner of things. But this year was kind of an off year. It was a weekday, and people were busy with things, and I just was, really looking forward, actually, to introducing my son to the delights of the spooky and the weird and the fun, the joy of Halloween. And we had a great time dragging that little pumpkin bucket around from house to house. And I live in San Francisco, and so there are many neighborhoods here that just go all out, and I live near one of them.
That's a great place to live. It really is.
Yeah, yeah, it's really fun. Yeah, I live in the Haight-Ashbury, actually, which I thought, you know, you might appreciate.
Well, I might appreciate that, yeah. Especially that particular town, you know. Especially when you're living over here on the East Coast and you're so close to the South. There's a lot of things we were not back in the late 60s ever allowed to do. If you went to the South, you were taking your life in your hands. I mean, if you think they beat up people that were gay or lesbian or homosexual or anything like that, you should see what they did to anyone that had a beard and long hair in those days.
You should see what they did to the witches.
Yeah. Well, millions. They did it to millions at times. So are you writing another book now?
I've got a couple ideas kind of in the works. I've been thinking a lot about sort of the origins of superstitions, mm-hmm. Something along those lines. And I've also got, there's more creatures. So, I'm very interested in writing something that gets a little bit more into pukas and changelings and goblins and things like that as well.
So. But you do touch on the pukas. God, I didn't know they had so many names that all sound look alike, and so many countries have them too. Geez, a whiz. You've really done a great job in educating us in these particular areas, and I've had such a wonderful time, especially when you, where else do you bump into William Butler Yeats? Whoa, gosh, or Rudy. So, Varla, thank you ever so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. This hour just flew by.
It did, didn't it?
It was an honor.
Yep,
thank you.
Really went so fast. Well, we'll be talking to you later. We'll be back, friends. When we come back, Dr. Larry Hogan, we're going to be talking about a century. Well, we're going to talk about something about baseball that I've never talked about before, and it's the clubbies. And I don't mean clubbies that nightclubs you hang out in, but the clubhouse. I had no idea what went on in clubhouses. Kind of.
Clock and breaking news now on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio, I'm Paul.